Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast.
Today I have Sean McKenna. Sean is a program manager in the Windows Phone application platform team. Sean, how are you?
Doing great. How are you, Jesse?
I'm very well and excited to have you here. I'm hoping that we can get to talk about Mango and what's new in Mango today.
Yeah, sounds great.
So what's the highlight for you?
So the area that I work on in particular is structured data access for Windows Phone. So giving our third-party developers access to a bunch of both the interesting content that's already on the user's phone in terms of like contacts and calendar and that sort of thing, as well as in Mango enabling database access for third-party applications, which was a popular request from our developers in 7.
Yes, that has been, it's interesting. People certainly seem very interested in that. And you always have to ask, what's the use case that people have in mind for that?
Yeah, well, we heard a lot of feedback about the types of applications that people would want to build. And really, there's a couple of categories. One of them is just, you know, reference data, what we call reference data applications. So the canonical example of this is a dictionary app. So in a dictionary, you can implement that really in two ways on the phone. You can create an app that calls out to some web service, like dictionary.com or something similar. And that's fine as long as you have network connectivity. But of course, on the phone, you know, you don't always have a network available. And so for something like a dictionary where you want to be able to do a lookup at any time, you need to have that content available locally. And so if you're going to have data that's, you know, on the order of, you know, hundreds of thousands of entries, as you would for a dictionary, you don't want to be parsing through that as just a flat XML or JSON file. And so, you know, developers told us that was an important scenario to enable with a database. One of the other interesting ones is where the user is entering a lot of information on the phone, and the application wants to keep track of that. So, for example, something like a shopping list or, you know, a food tracker or exercise tracker type application where every day I'm going in and entering, you know, the foods that I've eaten or the workouts that I've done, and the application wants to build up the relationships between those different bits of data and bring them together and display them in interesting ways. And again, that's a case where you'd want to be able to do queries across that ever-growing data set using a data API. And then the third one is something of a hybrid where you've got reference data that's available in the cloud. So some giant data set, you can imagine a lot of web services expose, you know, huge amounts of data through, say, REST APIs. But you want to have some subset of that available on the phone as a local cache, either that is specific to a particular user, things that they've chosen that they're interested in, or which is just kind of a subset as a reference. And so, you know, again, going back to something like a shopping list type application, maybe the information about products that you've put on your list is available through some web service. You want to pull that down and have, you know, the photo and the description of the product and maybe the most recent price available locally and not always have to go out and query that web service.
Yes. And that raises two sets of questions. One is about the syntax of using SQL to link to SQL. And yep. I'd like to come back to that. But before I do, when you talk about building a dictionary application, that seems to push on the issue of upper limits. And how much room can one get with a local database?
So you're limited to, I think we decided on 512 megabytes as a maximum size. And so, it, you know, that's pretty big for a phone application. It's certainly more than enough storage for even something like a dictionary. Now, the default size that we set for you is much smaller. I think it's 32 megabytes. And that's primarily just to limit the memory usage of your application if you're not actually using the larger database. But you can tweak that value upwards to 512.
And that's fairly substantial. And how much memory does the average user have as usable disposable memory on the phone?
In terms of storage cards?
Right.
I'd probably say it's something on the order of 8 to 16 gigabytes of storage. Mm-hmm. It definitely varies by device, but it's something in that range.
There was an issue with storage cards on at least some of the phones. Has that been resolved as far as you know?
I believe it has. Yeah, there was an issue with having expandable storage cards. Well, I should say, I don't know if it's been resolved per se. The issue was about having storage cards that are certified to work consistently on Windows Phone, that you could just pop in, expand out your storage, and be sure that you're going to have a great experience. I have seen, I think it was a couple months back, I saw some reports of SD cards that had been certified as being performant enough for our usage, but I don't know off the top of my head what brand or model those were. But I believe there are options out there now for people that want to expand their storage.
Great. I'll look into which cards they are and blog about that. That is going to be good news for a lot of folks. Let's go back to the methodology of writing for the local storage. And I do want to go to the other structured data as well, but let's stay with that for a bit. I know that the approach to that is to use Link to SQL.
Correct.
Is that a proper subset of all of Link to SQL, or how much of Link to SQL works with the phone?
So it's not a proper subset. We've basically taken some things out of Link to SQL from what shipped on the desktop back in .NET 3.5, I believe it was, and added a few things back in. And so we did that based on our analysis of what scenarios and what types of applications and really programming model makes sense on the phone. And so the primary thing that we removed from desktop Link to SQL was some of the backdoor functionality to enable access to ADO.NET objects or the ability to execute raw SQL. And really, when we looked at the landscape of what Link to SQL is used for on the desktop and what those APIs in particular are used for, it's primarily to interoperate with legacy databases where you're building a Link to SQL API or Link to SQL based application on top of an existing database. And there may be things like stored procedures in that database that you want to be able to call directly using raw SQL, or, you know, just based on the way that that database is structured, you need to do certain specific operations using those APIs. But since we're talking about building entirely new applications on the phone and applications that are using an embedded database in SQL CE, we didn't see that those APIs were necessarily required for those scenarios. And so we decided to scope down that API surface to just focus on giving our developers a clean managed interface, which is sort of the pure Link to SQL API. So that's the primary thing that we removed from the desktop. There's a few things that we added back in, the most significant of which is APIs to enable database upgrades. So in Link to SQL on the desktop, if you want to upgrade your database, you need to basically do that out of band from Link to SQL, either using those backdoor APIs that I mentioned to execute raw DDL statements against the database, or you just go directly through something like SQL Server Management Studio and, you know, do your modifications, and then you rev your object model on top of it. Since we're not providing those backdoor options, we needed to provide a managed API for developers to be able to update their database. And so what we've done is provide what we call a database schema updater, which gives you the opportunity to add the key things that you'll be adding to a database schema, which is tables, associations or foreign keys, columns, and indexes. So that allows you, as your application evolves and you add new features, you can continually update the underlying database schema and associated object model to work with it.
That sounds great. How is that done? Is that done within Link to SQL itself, or is there a tool, or what does that look like for the developer?
It is part of the core API set that we ship with the phone, but it is under the Microsoft.phone namespace. So whereas the portions of Link to SQL that we brought over from the desktop directly and basically kept intact are still in the system.data.link namespace that people know from the desktop, any of the new things that we've added that are specific to the phone are in the broader Windows or Microsoft.phone namespace. I believe these ones in particular are in Microsoft.phone.data.
Is there a way to use some of the tools like SQL Metal for setting up the phone development experience?
Yeah, so this is a pretty common question that comes up, particularly because people know that we're using SQL Server Compact under the hood, which is something that you can build database applications on the desktop with. And really the message is, if you use those tools and it works for you, then we'll keep it working in terms of, you know, we're going to maintain backward compatibility against anything that works in Mango. However, we haven't tested thoroughly tested all of those scenarios. So there may be things that you use the tools on the desktop to set up, and then you bring it over to the phone and it doesn't work. There will be cases like that. For example, I know in just playing around myself, I hit some issues with different encryption APIs. So if you try to pre-create a database on the desktop and put some encryption on top of it, bring that over to the phone, it's not necessarily going to work. But for the most part, those tools will work. So if people are familiar with them, by all means, you know, try them out and see how it works for you. But just that caveat that there may be things that don't. Particularly on SQL Metal, there are a few constructors. If you just take a SQL Server Compact database and run SQL Metal against it, the data context file that you get auto-generated will have a set of constructors that include parameters for some of those IDEO.NET specific object types. So you'll have to go through and remove those. But it's a pretty straightforward operation. If you just, you know, bring up that data context file in Visual Studio, you'll see all of the cases where it's saying, you know, I can't find a reference to this interface. Just rip those out. You'll be left with just the constructor that allows a connection string, which is the one that you want. And so, you know, beyond that, you know, most things should just work.
And what's your recommendation for people who are not yet familiar with any of this? They're relatively new to Link to SQL and they're going to go to it because that is the database scheme for the phone. Would you recommend that they tackle using SQL Metal or just write things directly by hand?
I would recommend if you're just starting out to do things by hand, SQL Metal will generate a lot of code. And so it's nice in the sense that it sets everything up for you, but it makes it a little bit more challenging to maintain over time if you want to make changes to your object model or your database schema. And so what I would recommend is get familiar with how to set up the base entities and associations between your entities by doing it in code. And we've got, you know, great documentation and I know, Jesse, you've put up some blog content on some of those just basic operations, and then build up your knowledge from there. And then once you've got kind of a base understanding of how things work, then you can go and play around with SQL Metal and see how the code gen works. And there may be things that you see, oh, you know, I can do this a little bit better, or, you know, tweak things this way or that, and, you know, pick up potentially some of those more advanced skills. But really what we're recommending overall is that people go with kind of what we call a code first model, where you're writing your objects first and then generating your database. And so getting familiar with how to write objects in a way that they can be persisted down to the database easily is a good skill to pick up if you're going to continue to do database programming on the phone.
And are there tricks or traps that you want to point out in terms of writing a class so that it can be serialized in that way?
There's a couple of things in particular around making database operations performant that it's probably good to point out. One thing is, in order to enable the most efficient and quickest update operations on your entities, we recommend that you put a version column in all of those entities. And this is it's a pretty simple thing to do. There's an attribute when you set up a column that you can call it, you know, is version equals true. And really all you need to do is create a column of binary type, and that'll set up that entity to have a version number associated with it. And what that does is allows us, when we're doing change tracking and preparing to do an update from the object model layer down to the database, we can do a very quick comparison between the data that we have up in the object model layer in the data context cache and what the latest information is in the database. Because as you can imagine, you could have multiple threads working against that same database. And so we need to make sure that we're doing consistency checks before we go and do an update. And if we have a version number associated with that entity, we can very quickly check whether the version that we have in the object model layer is the same one that was in the database. And then we can just go ahead and do the update. And that significantly speeds up the update operations that you might be doing, particularly as the size of the batch grows. So I think for something like 100 rows, we get on the order of like a 7x improvement in performance just by having that version column. So it's a slam dunk for performance to have that. One of the other ones related to optimizing performance is the iNotify property changing interface. So for people that are familiar with doing Silverlight development, whether on the desktop or on the phone, you're probably familiar with the iNotify property changed interface, which is the way that you notify Silverlight's data binding logic of changes in your object model so that those get surfaced up into your UI. What iNotify property changing enables is letting the link to SQL change tracking system and the data context within your application know that an entity is about to be changed. And what that allows us to do is when we're doing change tracking in link to SQL, we need to keep track of the initial original object that was pulled out of the database and a copy of that object that has been modified by your application in the object layer. There's one of two times that we can make that additional copy. We can either do it up front, in which case you will always have two copies of every object that's queried out of the database, or if you implement the iNotify property changing interface, then we know to only make that copy when you're about to make a change to that particular entity. And so if you can imagine, if you have 100 rows that you've queried out of your database and you've displayed those up into the UI for the user to modify, chances are they're probably only going to change one or two of them. And so, you know, you can limit down the number of copies that are required based solely on which entities are actually updated by the user. And so that one gets you a nice little memory usage benefit, which helps you keep under the platform cap of 90 megabytes. So
great. And I have a post on those two tips, so I will add a pointer to that in the page for this podcast, which those are two very powerful points. And the first one, the version control column, is an incredibly inexpensive thing to do for a huge payback.
Yeah, there's really no downside to doing it. And it's literally, you know, two lines of code on every entity. So every application should be taking advantage of that.
Now, you're also responsible, am I right, for the launchers and choosers that go into the contacts and the appointments?
Broadly speaking, yes. There's a lot of people that work on that area. But insofar as I kind of own our scenarios for access to interesting data on the phone, yeah, I'm involved in that.
And are there new choosers or launchers that we should know about in Mango?
Yeah, the one that's most interesting to me as structured data guy is the address chooser task. So in 7, we had a couple of different ways for developers to get access to properties of contacts in the user's address book. So you could get the phone number or the email address. And the way that works is you initiate one of those tasks, either the phone number chooser task or the email chooser task, and you launch it, and the inbuilt contacts chooser experience comes up with all the contacts. The user can scroll through them, choose a particular user, and then either the phone number or the email address gets returned back to the application, and they can do something interesting with that, like, you know, fire off an email to that person using the email compose task. And so, you know, some of the feedback that we got from developers was they wanted more of the properties of those contacts to be exposed. And in particular, you know, one that came up was an address. And so we've enabled an address chooser task. So basically the same workflow. You initiate the address chooser task, you launch it, the contacts experience comes up, user chooses a contact, and then your application gets back an address. And the nice thing about that task coming in Mango is that it pairs pretty well with another task that's been enabled, which is the Bing Maps directions task. And so now you can, you know, in a matter of 4 or 5 lines of code, get the address of somebody in your address book, get that back into your application, hand that off into the Bing Maps directions task, and then you can launch the built-in Bing Maps experience directly into our directions experience. And so you can very quickly find your way to your friend's house.
That's very cool. With about 6 lines of code.
Exactly. Yep.
That's great. What else is in Mango that we should know about that falls under your general area?
Well, the other big investment that we made was enabling direct access to the address book and to the user's calendar. And so, like I said, in 7, we had some access to the address book in the form of those choosers. So you could get specific properties for a particular contact, but your application couldn't really do anything in terms of querying against the address book or getting programmatic access to a bunch of the other properties on a particular contact. So, you know, the company they work for example. And so what we've done in Mango is enabled direct APIs for accessing both contacts and calendar. And so now you can do a search of the user's address book filtered based on a few different categories, you know, name, phone number, and so on, and get back an enumerable collection of contacts with the full contact details as they're available in the address book. And you can do a similar thing on the calendar side. You can do filtering based on time and get back a set of appointments, either, you know, past or future within the address book and display those up in your application. So it's another sort of class of data that developers have been clamoring for since 7. And so we've taken one step towards enabling that by providing read-only access to those two data stores. We're going to look at, in a future release, potentially opening that up for applications to write to those locations. But I think even with read-only access, there's a lot of interesting scenarios that are enabled.
Well, that's great. And that will open up a lot of application development, interacting with that information, and the combination of being able to access that information and also to be able to store more complex information in a relational database should open up a number of application types.
Yep. Yeah, we're pretty excited about it. And really, the feedback we've had from developers has been pretty positive as well. You know, people definitely thankful to finally have a database in the platform and to be able to get direct access to contacts and calendar information, as well as, you know, rounding out the tasks for choosing contacts. It's a pretty dramatic improvement from what we had in 7.
Sean, when you're sitting around and blue skying with your team or by yourself and thinking about features for upcoming releases, what comes to mind for you?
Well, the nice thing actually is we've got such a strong developer community that we don't necessarily have to sit around and dream up ideas all day. We get a lot of feedback from our developers about what we should be doing. And so there's a couple of things that we've heard pretty strongly from the community in these areas. One I just mentioned around write access to contacts and calendar information. And so generally when I talk about that, I try to make it pretty clear that the fact that we don't have write access to those locations in Mango was not a philosophical decision. We're not saying that we don't believe applications should have the capability to do that. It's just that we want to make sure that we take the time and do it right so that we balance the desire of application developers to, you know, put information into those stores with the desires of the end user, which is to make sure that those things are preserved and kept reasonably clean and not, you know, have some rogue application that can come in and really mess up your address book. So that's something that we're going to look at in future releases and see if we can come up with a model where the user still feels in control, but applications can plug in and really enrich that experience on the phone. The other one that we hear pretty loud and clear on the database side is for some form of synchronization solution. So it's a pretty common task that you want to get data from a web service down to the phone, potentially make some changes to it, push that back up to your service. And so there's a couple of different things that we'll be looking at there to see if we can enable at least a lightweight sort of sync solution for developers. So those are a couple of the things that we're looking at going forward. Hope to have more feedback from our community on exactly how they want those types of solutions to work and what the types of scenarios are that they want to enable. That's really helpful.